Hank Mobley, that's him on tenor sax with A Slice of the Top. It's a title track of this 1966 album, featuring also James Spaulding on alto sax, Lee Morgan on trumpet, Kiani Zawadi on euphonium. Who plays the euphonium anymore? I love the instrument, I really do. Howard Johnson on tuba, McCoy Tyner on piano, Bob Cranshaw on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and glad to meet with you one more day. I really am. Well, a couple of snippets, and then I get into the meat of the program. And one such snippet concerns Stacey Abrams. We talked about her concerning her desire to be the second in command of Joe Biden's office, presidential office. She wants to be vice president very, very badly, and she is not hiding it. She has talked openly about it, and we talked about it here too, saying, is this necessarily the best way to go about this, that you announce your intention, you announce, you know, that you want to come in as number two on the presidential ticket? It's a very different approach, but that's the approach she has taken. But I'm referring today to her pronouncement that she believes Joe Biden, she says. I believe Joe Biden. What is this all about? Well, the previous chat that we had a couple of days ago was about a very interesting problem that has cropped up. One, of course, is about Stacey Abrams making it known without being asked that she wants to be vice president on Biden's ticket. But beyond that, we were talking about this charge, a matter that has been hanging over Biden's head since 1993, that matter being a sexual assault question, charge. A young lady by the name of Tara Reid has come forward, as she did before, and she accused Joe Biden of sexually assaulting her in 1993 in the hallway of a congressional office. And the matter apparently just swept under the rug, and nothing has happened to it since then, since 1993. There have been no investigations, no probing of anything, and it's just been left there dangling. Well, in recent weeks, Ms. Reid has decided that she is not going to let this just disappear. And she has, reinvigorated the charge, demanding an investigation. And it is in this regard that Stacey Abrams, who wants to be Joe Biden's second in command, if and when he gets into the White House, and she's not waiting to be asked. She has made it clear that that's what she wants. And just to add on some more information to that, Stacey Abrams, an African-American woman, very smart, very capable, and many high-profile African-American leaders have expressed a desire to see her basically be elevated into some kind of a high-profile position within the bind. Sorry, Joe Biden. Joe. I keep getting stumped with names. His administration. Okay. So now she has come out and said that she believes in Joe Biden. Now, that further compounds the problem, doesn't it? Why do people feel the need to take sides about something they know nothing about? Well, of course, we know this is her way of indicating to to Biden that, you know, she's pledging her troth and doing so publicly. This is her direct quote. I believe Joe Biden. All right, but that's not the issue, is it? The issue isn't whether you believe Joe Biden or you don't believe Joe Biden. The issue is, what does the evidence suggest? What is the evidence against Biden? And why hasn't this case come to some kind of trial since 1993? That is the question. We don't care whether you believe him or you don't believe him, it's not an issue. So why now do you feel the need to further impose yourself into this matter by publicly announcing support for Biden by way of stating, I believe Joe Biden? By the way, that also means you don't believe the young woman, which is a silly place to put yourself. You don't have information about the specifics of this case. You don't have access to documents or evidence. This case has not yet come to trial. And when you publicly take a side like that, and you say, I believe Joe Biden. By default, you're saying, I don't believe this woman. And are we in a position to say that? What makes you so confident that you can unequivocally state that Biden has done nothing wrong? The case hasn't even come to trial. See, this is what people do when they start getting desperate. In the first instance, you don't, you know, decide that this is where you want to land in Joe Biden's camp and as his second in command, as his vice president. You don't decide that. That may be something you privately wish for, but it is downright stupid to go public and make the case that not only do you want to be there, but further you intimate that you ought to be there. And he hasn't asked you. That's the whole thing. He hasn't asked you. You may not be the kind of person he wants. So all of this is indicating to me, you're sending the wrong signals. You're too eager. You're too pushy. Nobody has asked you. Then you can let it be known to people, you know, the black leaders who are routinely consulted on these matters. You have a relationship with them, You can call them up and say, hey, you know, Reverend Al, as in Sharpton, you know, I want to talk to you about something, and could you set aside some time so we can talk? You make an appointment, and you go and talk. And you ask his advice after you tell him what you want to do. You want to be part of Biden's campaign. These are matters you discuss sotto voce, right under the table, low voices, nobody else around. And you elicit from the likes of Sharpton and others how they react to your desire to be a vice presidential candidate. If you were to proceed with that, is there a way that they could influence that decision? These are the kinds of things you talk in private about. You don't go out there when nobody asked you, nobody invited you, nobody probably wants you on that team. So far, nobody has expressed such a desire, and you have done everything. You've somersaulted, you have waved flags, you have done all the bells and whistles to indicate your interest in landing there without anybody asking you. And now you compound it by pronouncing that I believe Joe Biden. Well, good for you. But I was hoping you would have considered before you made such a pronouncement that this matter has not come to trial. You have no access to any evidence or information. You're expressing a gut feeling about a very serious matter. This is the time, precisely the time, that you shut up and just observe how things are unfolding. Your believing in Biden doesn't change any facts related to the alleged sexual assault. It's embarrassing that you have to tell people this. People who are so well educated, people who have such expertise and experience, you don't do these things. And apart from which, you know, you're seen as groveling practically. My God, for dignity's sake, shut up. Say nothing. You can confide in people who are close to Biden, if you trust that process, and say, you know, I've been thinking, I really, really would like if Mr. Biden could see me and we can talk and I could tell him how enthusiastic I am about his campaign, blah, 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 blah. But that's on one level. That has to do with your desires to move forward in life. This matter is a legal matter. It could possibly result in the conviction of Joe Biden on sexual assault charges. You don't know, but you're out there, you put your name out there, you put yourself out there, you put your credibility out there, you put your so-called professional expertise out there, and you're putting it on the line for something you have no information about. My goodness. This is elementary stuff. So that's what I wanted to say. It is always disappointing when people with such talent and such, you know, qualifications and who could be very exciting, who could be very useful, sink to such levels that they literally are groveling in service of the fulfillment of a desire, a personal desire. You so badly want to be on the ticket that you would risk your professional expertise, your reputation, everything, to pronounce, all but pronounce him innocent of any charges, and you don't know a damn thing. I believe Joe Biden. Well, here's the thing, Stacey Abrams. It's not about what you believe. It never has been about what you believe. For that matter, you should maintain a position. You don't believe anybody until you see the evidence. You have not seen any evidence. You have not talked to this woman. You don't know anything. Shut up and go about your business. Because you may just be embarrassing yourself. You may just be embarrassing yourself and compromising everything you have tried to achieve professionally in your life by so easily giving Joe Biden. He hasn't even asked you. He hasn't even asked you. It's you conjuring up in your head that he will. And he will because you've made it plain that that's what you want. Lady, you don't understand how this works. And I'm stunned. I am stunned that you do not understand the complexity of the situation and how you ought to operate at this time. Shut up. That's how you operate. Shut up. Wait and see how things go. We all want to know. There are many questions that need to be answered. And it is Joe Biden. Joe Biden has to account. Not you, not this young woman. She's already gone to the authorities. She has already shared the information. She has already discussed the details of what happened to her. That's on record. What, if you want to call attention to anything, call attention to the fact that this case has been jettisoned. It has been made to disappear since 1993. Surely it is not unreasonable to expect Joe Biden by now to have accounted for himself, to have been questioned about it. And it's a serious charge, a very serious charge. So that's what I have to say about Stacey Abrams. You disappoint me, Stacey. I always thought that you were a very smart, a very astute woman. But you're not acting like a person with a brain. You're acting like a despondent, over-anxious. You're dying for something. You're looking for a handout of a wonderful position, Vice President of the United States, the first black woman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Your mind is shot, if that's the way you're thinking. You're not thinking right. All right, so I have said my piece on that. We'll see where it goes from here. We'll see whether Biden actually is compelled to address this matter. And again, this is without making any judgment as to whether he's innocent or guilty. Not at all. That is not even my consideration. My consideration is, it looks funky when a charge has been hanging on, going without being prosecuted since 1993. And it's because you were a senator at the time, you enjoyed a certain amount of extra privileges. This is a staffer who came forward and made this charge. There are people who have come forward also and testified that at the time, she confided in them, including her mother, including the next door neighbor, including other friends. And she told them what happened. Let's have a trial. That's all I'm saying. You're not required to believe one or the other, as Ms. Abrams believes that she has to do. You're not required to express belief. If anything, you should be insisting that the matter be cleared up, that there should be a trial, and we'll all know. But to now do the typically democratic thing and prove your loyalty without being asked for it, you feel the need to be to jump in and put your body in front of Biden to protect him from prosecution. Oh my God, that is so pathetic. Especially from a bright, smart woman like you. Two words that you should live by. Shut up. It will do you good. I want to talk now about more like a personal diary of personal observations. A friend of mine, he's like a brother. We worked very closely together when I was in New York, and we have remained close. He too is a journalist. I don't want to mention his name because he might feel a little bit uncomfortable about that. But he called me to let me know that his 85-year-old mother had died. She died in a nursing home in New York. She was transferred to a nursing home in Manhattan. She was a victim of the coronavirus. She didn't last long. This is a woman who had defied cancer, and she was leading a productive life. And out of the blue comes this finding that she has the coronavirus. Within a short time, she loses her capacities. She can no longer communicate. She is completely different from what she used to be. And she deteriorated rapidly. And he told me that at the center where she was taken, nursing home, that there were nurses who did everything they could to provide her the best. He had no question about it. He particularly cited two nurses who went beyond their shifts even to take care of her. But still she deteriorated. And then when I last talked with him, it was to alert me to the fact that his mother had died. The sad thing was that none of her children were allowed to say goodbye to her personally. They were allowed to look through a glass window as her body was being prepared for transport. So the one thing that he wanted more than anything else after she had died was just to say goodbye. That did not happen for him or for any of his siblings. And he mused with me that he knew that his mother would have been very upset that life had come to an end without any of her children saying goodbye and without her saying goodbye to any of her children. But these were the circumstances and they had to obey the rules and keep apart from each other. Now, normally he's not a very emotional guy, but I could tell that he was torn up by this thing, torn up completely. He had always described his mother to me as a warrior, how tough she was, how she raised her family by herself. How she never frowned or quarreled or was disagreeable, always smiling, always looking for ways to help other people. He would tell me what she had in Trinidad. It's called a sweet hand. That's when people are really good at cooking. She had a sweet hand. And he was very close to his mother. But there was no dignity at the end, and not the smallest bit of ceremony, the ceremony of saying goodbye. But she knew, even in death, she was not going to be a burden. She had selected where she wanted to be buried years before. She had her plot ready, and everybody knew what she wanted. The daunting thing was that nobody could say goodbye. That really struck home. I raise this, and I share this with you to talk about what we are experiencing. It struck me as odd that a country beset by this virus, so many people dying, so many people confirmed as having contracted this disease. According to the Johns Hopkins University, which has been tracking these numbers, more than 3.1 million people in the United in the world, sorry, more than 3.1 million people in the world have tested positive, and more than 218,000 have died. In the United States, more than 1 million people have been confirmed as having the disease, and more than 58,000 people have died. What struck me all of a sudden was that there has been no official mourning in this country. You would think that the President of the United States would say, what a loss we have suffered and still continue to suffer. Let's just declare a day, a national day of mourning. People need something to reconnect, if not with the person directly, but with the experience that they have had in having to deal with the death of these people. You know, that's a lot of people. 58,000 people to have died in this country. And there's no official indication by government that that is considered a great loss for the country. Or of the people who are left to deal with the fact that they are infected, that that is something that we're not disconnected from them in that regard. I was not a direct member of the family, but I felt it. That was a very sad way to go. Where your children cannot even touch your hand or your forehead or stroke your hair. And they're looking at you. You passed away. There's no comfort in that moment. There's no way to express individually or collectively this great sense of loss that they will carry with them for the rest of their lives. And it says something about the leadership in a way. We don't certainly have to wait until a president declares time to mourn. I mean, we do that on our own. But it says something that this administration, it is not even important to do something like that, just to let people know, we know you're suffering. And we declare this day in honor of those you were connected to and who were connected to you. And hopefully this small gesture gives you solace. It recognizes that you and your family, you shared a life that has now ended because of a disease. They didn't ask for it. But no such thing has happened in this country. The country refused and still refuses to stop and say, let's just gather or regather ourselves. Let's just focus on the lives that we have lost. and on the ways in which they shaped our lives. No such thing in this country. No basic human expression of loss, sense of loss. So we don't even get that from this administration. We don't get a sense of awareness that the country, many people in this country, are suffering severe loss. And that their loved ones are no longer here. But when they were here, if you were to hear the stories about them, as I said, my friend talked all the time about this 85-year-old mother of his who knew no fear. All she knew was what had to be done, and she was about to go get it done. Took care of all of her children and her grandchildren. Yeah, that's a crazy thing to ignore that in every family that is mourning. There are deep reasons. Is it too much to ask for a nation to say, let us pause? We know it continues. We know the slaughter continues by the coronavirus. We know the damage it has done and continues to do. But just to say that we recognize that you are suffering, we recognize that you are in mourning, and we pausing in this moment to give you hope and the strength that you have gotten, to draw on it and to remind yourselves that it's not impossible. You can go on with your life in memory of those who are no longer with us. So many people have been removed from communities. That's a devastating loss. They're removed from the professions that they had, that had great impact, whether we think of it or not. Maybe the deceased person was a teacher or a great carpenter or a taxi driver. But performed his professional duties well, or her duties well. They took care of their families. They were concerned about that as a number one item. They weren't concerned about Democrats and Republicans. They were concerned about their families and their communities. And I think it says something that we can't find it, and we haven't found it in our hearts as a nation. The leadership of this nation doesn't have the compassion, the humanity to observe a symbolic moment of silence for all that we have lost together. I think it is so sad. So sad. that we can talk about all the great things we're doing and we're sending rockets to the moon and we have all these things happening, sure. But you have no compassion. You have no humanity. And you don't mind if other people see it. Donald Trump doesn't have a human heart. And all the people around him share the same characteristics. I want to stop time and, you know, tell the nation, share with the nation, mourn with the nation, and even celebrate with the nation that, as tragic as it is that we've lost all these people, let us make a commitment in their name to do better as a nation. That's the kind of thing leaders would do. But we don't have leaders. We have politicians and people who want to get ahead. And they can't get ahead if they devote time to silly things like mourning, like calling the nation together, like tending to our wounds. The attitude is just continue going on with your life. It tells you something. I can't imagine any place else subjected to this much suffering in such a short time, a powerful expression of loss, and there's no reaction recognizing that. It's just that we go on and campaigns go on and life goes on the American way. I'll take a break now, and we have some time for a couple of comments about how you have experienced these last few months as people around you suddenly were taken out of our lives. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead, and we're just taking a moment. I felt a need to do that today. Just take a moment and reflect on the ways in which we truly are connected to each other. Tens of thousands of people who no longer are with us, and yet they made an investment. They did good work. They raised their families. And they did things to elevate us and elevate our communities. And I wondered, in the middle of all of this craziness that we're going through, and with the coronavirus still wreaking havoc in our lives, do we think about in moments like this that give us solace and comfort and the will to go on? Jay from New York, you're on the air.
How are you, Utrice? How are you feeling? Okay. And how are you doing?
I'm hanging in.
First, I'd like to say the president doesn't have the moral aptitude nor the character to give America a day of mourning. The man can't even take blame for anything that he may have done wrong in regards to this virus. So what would one think would allow him to now set forward something in regards to mourning for all of the people who have suffered the loss of loved ones? I mean, he's more concerned.
But we're not talking about him, really. He does not matter. He's not a central character here. We're talking about us.
Yeah, but he's...
And how are we dealing with such loss? What is this moment teaching us?
Well, he's the leader of the country. He's...
Yeah, but again, we're not talking about... Don't have him pollute our environment at this time. We'll get to him another time. What we want to talk about is how are people feeling? How are we coping? What is the thing that is pulling us through? What do we depend on at this time outside of any political consideration? We're not interested in that right now.
The nation believe in our moral principles in regards to how we deal with such a tragedy about this. But what I was really calling for was your statement earlier in regards to Stacey Abrams. I don't think no way in God's green earth that Joe Biden is going to pick Stacey Abrams or any other black person to become his vice president.
I have to interrupt. The reason is we're not talking about Stacey right now. We talked about her. That's it. We're talking about how are we dealing with the loss in our communities, our families. How are we getting through? And what is the right attitude that we should have at this moment to kind of figure out the next move, irrespective of the president? I'm not even putting him in this equation. I don't want him in this equation. It is about us. About us. What do we draw from this experience that would help us heal and understand that life goes on, but that we should also look at what we were able and privileged to experience, because those who have gone on have contributed so much in our lives. Thanks, Jay, for calling. E from Edgewater, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice.
Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the loss that your friend's family had lost their mother, and they weren't able to, touch her hair or say anything to her closely. I had my mom in 2013, she passed, and she was in a nursing home for 7 years, but at least I had the chance to be with her every day and at her last moments. I know what that means. The inhumanity that we are experiencing in this planet right now is at such a level, it's just a disgrace. And I feel so bad for your friend. And I my heart goes out to them and mourn their loss. And the loss of any families that lost their loved ones like this, so terrible. I just don't know what else to say, Eutrice. It's just...
You said quite a bit. You said quite a bit, E. And I thank you for your heartfelt expression. And, it tells us what... We never stop to think, in our regular daily lives, that we're walking around with deep scars, deep wounds inside of us because of loss. And how important it is that this nation should recognize that and give some space for people to reconcile their loss. It's so important. And yet, we're months into this, and no such thing has happened. I thank you so much, and I hear you. I hear you today. Thank you. Gwen from New York, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes,
hi.
I'm very touched by your story as well. I am on a radio show every Tuesday about prison. Ralph Pointer, who was Lynn Stewart's husband, has a radio show. And one of these callers, or one of the persons who puts it together, producers, read a list of the places in New York that have had the losses last night, the statistics. And she was reading there was a county that's next to the Bronx that had zero deaths and zero cases, they say. And then you get to the Bronx, and there's 2,000 deaths in the Bronx. And then you come over to Queens, and there's like another, you know, huge number there. And it's very strange, the places that it's hitting. And my own personal response to this is I'm trying to stay on top of my parents, who are 97 and 93, and making sure that they are, you know, that they don't let anybody in the house, that they have their masks on. My parents are so crazy. They don't understand about the masks. They went out to the store last week, to CVS. They put their mask on. They thought they were doing really great. And they got in and they took them off. I said, why don't you take your mask off? I said, the mask, you're supposed to put them on when you get to the store. But trying to stay on top of my parents sometimes is like herding cats. But I'm really, really lucky that my mom and dad are fiercely independent and would not live in any kind of a group home or anything like that. They insisted on staying in their apartment that they own until they die and live with all of the things that might end up going with that. So I'm very lucky. But living in New York, the best emotional part of the day, believe it or not, is at 7 o'clock, because even when it's raining and it's gray and it's horrible outside, you open up your window and you start banging on whatever you got. And I see my neighbors. I see this one little boy across the street at the homeless shelter, and he's out there every night. And I smile at him, and he smiles back. And it's just, we're all kind of hovering, wondering what's going to happen next. I met a woman at the park last week. I know for years as a nurse. She is a nurse. I know her because she was walking her dogs, and I saw her. She was walking her dogs in between shifts, and it was a beautiful day, and everybody was in pretty good mood. And she said, you know, I don't know. I just feel this sadness. And she said, and I can't really be sad, because she said, I know when I go back in, she said, there is so much. There's no time for that. She said, I just don't have time for it.
Absolutely. Well, we're running out of time. I'm so sorry, but we have to end it here. We can pick this up again. It's a very important subject, because we are also dealing with sorrow all the time now. And we are fighting in some cases against it, but we know it's there. And it's there because we haven't dealt with it really effectively. We have to acknowledge it. And we also, it's a way of thanking people who have been in our lives, that they have meant so much to us, that their absence, we feel the loss. We feel the loss. All right. Thanks so much, Gwen. Thank you all for calling in today. We'll connect again tomorrow. Until then, keep people in your hearts. Keep them in your hearts. They live forever.